All right, I guess we can probably start. So I'm Esteban Gazelle. I'm a geologist and a geochemist, and I'm going to talk... this is also my first CIDR, so I'm very excited to be here. And so I'm going to talk about how we can use information from melt to understand melting processes inside the Earth and also heterogeneity inside the Earth. So I first need to acknowledge that a lot of the slides that I'm going to show and a part of the theoretical background that I'm going to show today come from Claude Hertzberg. He was one of my PhD advisors. And so Claude is also, besides being an excellent petrologist, he's an artist. So I'm going to show some of his art here today. So what about volcanoes? You know, humans have always been fascinated with volcanoes. I grew up surrounded by volcanoes, and you know that fascination grew with me. But more than anything, not just the eruption itself, but the fact that volcanoes, to me, are probes to the deep Earth. For me to try to understand heterogeneity inside planet Earth, I go and I sample volcanoes. And that's what geochemists do. You guys go, the seismologists can go and put some instruments and try to sample the heterogeneity with an indirect measurement, but we think that we actually go and at least grab the rock and we have a more direct measurement of what is going on inside the planet. And come on, just give me a break. Look at all these wonderful places we go to sample Earth material. And what is really cool is the fact that the major and trace element composition, the isotopic composition that Dominique is going to talk later, of this melts are telling us a lot of interesting stories about what is happening inside planet Earth. I also need to make an announcement before I forget. The tutorial this afternoon is going to be on how we use melt to calculate mantle potential temperatures. So you can either download 3 Excel files that are in my tutorial wiki section, or also you got an email from Bruce. Please get those files before the tutorial. Be sure that they're in your desktop or someplace in your computer, because if everybody tries to download those files later at the same time, then there's going to be some downloading problems. And then we're going to spend half of the tutorial downloading files rather than working on those files. All right, everybody knows, just get those files. All right, so what do I say that volcanoes, why is that the volcanoes are props to the deep Earth? Well, you know, if we want to sample the heterogeneity produced by eons of subduction and mantle convection, the place that we can go and sample that is going to be either intraplate volcanoes like Hawaii to try to understand that heterogeneity in areas away from subduction. We can go to continental arcs to understand how continents evolve, or we can go to mid-ocean ridges and sample the mantle that is just upwelling and melting passively. Okay, so today I'm going to talk about mantle rocks. And what is the mantle made of? We saw in some previous presentations that most people talk about the mantle mostly made of peridotite and olivine, and then all those other phases that happen when olivine breaks down and evolve into phases that are more happy with the high pressures inside planet Earth. But every time anything is put into the mantle by subduction, we're adding new components. So the mantle is not only made of peridotite. We have recycled components like this eclogite here that is there. And it's going to change the composition of the mantle with time, too. The how those heterogeneities are mixed and how those heterogeneities come back to the surface is still a mystery. We know from numerical models that they could disappear really fast, but they keep coming back. So there is still a lack of connection between our better understanding of how these heterogeneities survive. All right, so a lot of the theoretical framework that I'm going to be showing today is based on experimental petrology. I really acknowledge the work of experimentalists because they are the champions of the field. They spend a lot of time in the lab making experiments, and making experiments is incredibly challenging, but also frustrating. So you need a special kind of person to do these experiments. And I think this is probably the first molten rock experiment in the 19th century with Clarence King. You can imagine this like a British gentleman trying to make experiments to simulate melt. Because their idea was, there was this big debate of how volcanoes are formed, and if the crust was formed by basically drying this primordial ocean, or the crust was formed by volcanoes. And that was kind of the fact, the big fight they had during the time. Like now we have these arguments between mantle plumes existing or not. During that time, they were more related with a more biblical explanation of the planet. So you can imagine all this British gentlemen. And the first experiments, they just dig a hole and they throw a lot of stuff there, like sulfur and things, and they basically make like fireworks. And that, of course, is not going to simulate the way the planet works, but eventually, they were able to prove that the melting curve of basalt will basically reach the geothermal gradient. So by doing these experiments that are totally wrong in our understanding today, they were able to prove that actually you can melt basalt inside the Earth. So today we have much better experiments. And if you want to have an idea of how these experiments are made, I really invite you to read this Outreach article that Christy Teal and Michael Krasinski wrote about what are the different instruments that are used and what we can get from experiments. And it's a really nice piece to basically promote the works of experimentalists. But at the end, you know, what we have is, this is just one example where experimentalists take materials of a composition of a peridotite or a basalt or whatever they want to melt, and they basically put those materials at high pressures and temperatures, and they simulate melting inside Earth. From those experiments, then we can take thermodynamic data and composition that can be used to apply to our understanding of how the mantle melts on planet Earth. All right, so let's just start with mid-ocean ridges. Basically, this is the outline of my talk. I'm going to talk about melting in mid-ocean ridges, melting in subduction zones, and then melting and heterogeneities in mantle plumes and other forms of intraplate magmas. All right, mid-ocean ridges. So what do we know? They are formed where two plates separate. Everybody here knows that. They are probably the most continuous fissures or structures on planet Earth. They are more dramatic than any of the subaerial mountain ranges, and they have in the order of 65,000 kilometers in length. So these are really, really big structures. And what is really interesting is that the volume of crust produced is in the order of about 20 cubic kilometers per year. Nothing today produces more magma than a mere ocean ridge. But just because they're underwater, we keep forgetting that. You know, we look at the volcanoes erupting and we think that they produce a lot of magma, but it's actually these mid-ocean ridges that are constantly producing magma. We have generally two to three types of ridges. We have low spreading ridges like the Mid-Atlantic, and we have fast spreading ridges like the East Pacific Rise. And you can see the morphology. This is the East Pacific Rise, and this spreads so fast, and you can barely see the morphology of the ridge. While the Mid-Atlantic Ridge here, and the Carlsberg Ridge, these are slow spreading ridges, and they actually have a more defined morphology. They produce less magma, but the morphology is more defined. And we also have ultra-slow spreading ridges, like the Gackle Ridge, where the morphology is even more dramatic. And in the Gackle Ridge, there is less magma production. There is more just exposure of the upper mantle by extension rather than melting. So it's a really unique environment in planet Earth. All right, so the composition of mantle peridotite that is going to be the main component of the upper mantle that is going to melt to produce a mid-ocean ridge is here. So we have high magnesium. We have about 8% iron, 44% silica. But the important part here is magnesium. We're going to talk a lot about magnesium and iron today. The most you can melt the mantle, the higher the magnesium of the melt component that is going to come from there. An average mid-ocean rich primary magma has something like 11 to 12% MgO. So how we go from here to here? How we melt the mantle to produce this? Okay, so I'm going to go back to this seminal paper by Charlie Lamure in the 90s. So this is a really cool paper because it relates melt generation with basically the upwelling of mantle below a mid-ocean ridge. And in this paper, basically they focus on two types of mid-ocean ridges. One that could be, well, this is the one that will be like a normal mid-ocean ridge, and this could be a mid-ocean ridge that is affected by a thermal anomaly and therefore will produce more magma. So there is this triangle that forms when two plates are extending, and this is the area where melt is going to generate. And basically, as the mantle rises through here, it's going to continue melting, and then eventually melt aggregates and come to the surface. And that's what is called an aggregated melt. Different stages of melting will end in a melt that comes to the surface that is the result of different degrees of partial melting that aggregate at the end. In that paper, they also found global trends. Not all mid-ocean ridges are the same, and there are trends that they were explained by different reasons in this paper. But what is interesting is that they found a clever way to correct for fractionation. So basically what is moving melts from this composition to the one here is fractional crystallization. But in this paper, what they did is that they backtrack at compositions of magnesium 8. So for example, when people say in a lot of papers, like the one that Su Joy showed from Colleen Dalton, they talk about sodium 8. Sodium 8 is basically, if you backtrack the composition of a basalt, if it had magnesium 8. So it's basically going back in these trends. And interesting result from doing that global calculation is that there is a really good correlation between crustal thickness and sodium 8. Sodium is an incompatible element that's telling us that the least sodium you have, the least the degrees of partial melting was. And the way they explain this is basically based on isostasy. The most you melt the mantle, the most you're going to have to compensate below that. All right, let's talk a little bit about partial melting. In a mid-ocean ridge tectonic environment, melting is produced by mantle decompression. Basically, we are releasing pressure and keeping temperature constant. Melt is produced with the whole material rise and decompress, and the liquid is generally more buoyant than the matrix, and it's going to come and erupt. The type of melting is called aggregated fractional melting. It's not batch melting, like we could model really easily. It's a little bit more complicated than that. An aggregated fractional melting is what I mentioned before. Droplets of melts are formed, or batches of melts are formed, and then all those different batches aggregate. And then the end melt that you have in the surface is the result of that aggregation. All right. So, do you guys probably remember this from petrology? Let's just start with a simple liquid dioxide anorthite phase diagram. So this, and this is an example of isobaric equilibrium melting. We start with a composition over here, and at certain point we cross this boundary called the solidus. I'm going to be showing solidus.
Sorry to interrupt. I'm going to ask a really dumb question on purpose, and it's not dumb. What is diopside? What is anorthite? Why are you showing us this? And none of us took petrology.
So who took petrology here? Come on, raise your hand. I think you're wrong. Many people took petrology here. I don't know, Manny. You didn't take petrology, maybe.
I didn't take petrology.
All right. I guess we have equal number of people here, but look at Maureen was talking about, like, you know, the LPOs in olivine crystals and. All right, so diopside is a pyroxene anorthite is a plagioclase. So here we have a very simple system. It's three components: a pyroxene, a plagioclase, and melt. And the reason I'm showing this is because it's as simple as you can make it. I guess you can make it olivine and liquid and make it even simpler. But it's basically to show what happened as an analogy of the more complicated things that are coming in the future, okay? So this is what is called a phase diagram. And this is the weight percent of two components, diopside and anorthite. And this is a solution between the two components, okay? You can imagine that. The two components are there. And we can start here, and what I'm doing there is increasing temperature. Keeping composition constant, but now I'm increasing temperature. So what happens when you increase temperature to things? They eventually melt. And that's what happened here. So we cross the first line, and that's a thermodynamically defined line called the solidus. So whenever I show a solidus in one of my diagrams, it means it's when the first drop of melts appear. And then there's another line called the liquidus. And the liquidus is when everything turns into melt. So if you have 100% melt, you reach the liquidus. For example, a magma ocean will be all liquidus. Mostly what we have is partial melt. So we live in, and so this was just my way to start talking about melting with a diopside anorthite phase diagram.
More dumb questions. What's the red line, and what does it have to do with the blue blob?
Okay, so the red line is what is called if we're crystallizing, is the liquid line of the sand, and this dot here is what is called the eutectic point. And that's a point when you have multiple components that they're gonna melt at the same time. If you only have one component, it's easier. Jesus, I didn't know this was gonna be so much questions here. Yeah. So if you're coming the other way around, if you're lowering temperature, what happens when you lower temperature for something that is completely molten? It will crystallize. So if you're gonna lower temperature, then this is the line between these two components here that is called the liquid line of the sand. And I'm gonna talk about that later too. And at certain point, when it reaches that point, the two components, diopside and anorthite, are gonna crystallize there in equilibrium with the liquid. Roberta?
I just wanted to add that one of the reasons that diopside anorthite binary phase diagram is a popular one to look at is because it approximates, it's a very simplification, of course, of what real rocks are like, but it approximates a basalt composition. So it's a good one to talk about if you're talking about basalts.
Because basalts they have plagioclases and they have pyroxenes. All right, let's look at.
So you probably didn't expect that you will stay in this slide this long. So could you go back? So I've been always fascinated about this eutectic behavior. So what is the physical reason that particular point in a composition prefers to melt first? Or in a reverse way, can you physically predict a eutectic composition out of a given composition?
It's a very simple answer. It's the place where the free Gibbs energy is minimum. So it's controlled by that. But I think Kanani mentioned.
Well, I accept it as a descriptive explanation, but I'm looking for more theory side of explanation. Like, why that particular amount of cation combination is going out rather than something others. Energy explanation is a description, right?
Well, but everything is controlled by energy.
Yeah, yes, that is right. But like more.
Kanani said that yesterday, like everything is lazy, you know, like you're gonna, you need to mind. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Anyway.
So let me rephrase my question then.
Why? Gibbs free energy is lowest when you take out those particular component as a melt. Mm. That's actually my question. Yeah. Why that is energetically lowest?
Yeah, I don't know that answer in the top of my mind. Why the free energy is going to be minimum there? Yeah. But that's it's a physical parameter that describes the system. I need to think a little bit more about this.
I just tried to answer your question. So in order to have eutectic type phase diagram, you need to have enthalpy of mixing doesn't equal to zero. Basically, it means that it's not the ideal mixing. The ideal mixing and the non-ideal mixing, the fundamental difference is the, let's consider a very simple like mixing of alloy, like say copper and silver. If, like what Connie said yesterday, if those atoms like each other, they can substitute freely with each other, then this is so-called ideal mixing. The substitute of one atom with another doesn't change the enthalpy of the system. But if those two atoms doesn't like each other, and when they substitute each other, it changes the enthalpy of the system, then that's a non-ideal system. For non-ideal, we can generate this kind of eutectic phase diagram. For ideal, we cannot have an inflection point in the phase loop. Okay. Therefore, that's a so-called sorry solution.
My understanding may be imperfect, but my understanding is there's no mixing going on here. These are discrete phases. They don't dissolve into each other. So these are there are binary mixing diagrams like the Plagioclase yeah. solid solution or olivine solid solution. But this is pure diopside, pure anorthite. And those liquidous surfaces could be plotted as a plane if you had pressure as a third dimension. And those are the Gibbs free energy, the minimum Gibbs free energy. And where they intersect defines where the eutectic is. And that eutectic point will change if you change something like pressure. Does that make any sense?
But again, like I think his question is like, what controls the free Gibbs free energy of the system is defined by that triple point, and I really don't know that answer right on the top of my head.
I don't know the answer either, but it's an observation. If you melt your system, and any proportion, you're always going to end up at a given pressure with the lowest temperature of melting with 40% diopside and 60% anorthite.
I think the mixing happens in the liquid. So when you, in the solid part, you don't have mixing between diopside and anorthite. That's why you have a eutectic phase diagram. But if it's phosphorite and phthalate, they can have completely solid solution, yeah. Then you don't have this type of phase diagram. So you have mixing in the liquid, but not in the solid. And in the liquid, you have the mixing of the entropy term, the actual entropy of mixing okay. term that lowers the free energy in the liquid. And because the diopside and anorthite are different, so they have different internal energies. So when you add the mixing, entropy of mixing, and then the combination of this would give you a particular eutectic composition. That's my understanding.
Okay. Can we move on to another slide, please? All right. So let's talk about fractional melting. So what fractional melting means is, well, there's a cartoon more or less of what is going on. We have a mantle peridotite and it melts, and there is a residue and there is a liquid, okay? And the idea of is that you have these instantaneous fractional melts that are always in equilibrium with the residue. But once you remove them from the residue, they are no longer going to be in equilibrium. Make sense? And so we can use the batch melting equation or the equilibrium melting equation from Shaw. And what we can do is we can simulate fractional melting by making a bunch of increments of the batch melting equation. And what do we mean by all these different components? I don't know if you can see it, but we start with a concentration of an element of an oxide in the source. And that will always change as we remove melt. There's going to be a concentration in the liquid. Liquid is going to be the melt that is being removed from that solid. Then there's going to be something we call the melt fraction, that is the quantity of melt that is being removed. And we have these distribution coefficients that rule partition between phases and melt. Okay. All right. All these parameters are the ones that we owe to experimentalists. That their work is the reason why we can then go and model processes inside the Earth. And basically, a primary magma is a magma that basically accumulate all these different batches of melt into a single aggregated melt. Primary magmas do not exist. Primary magmas are model. A primitive melt can be found in a volcano, but a primary magma is almost impossible to find. Because once this melt separates and it starts crossing the lithosphere, cross the crust, it fractionates things, it's no longer going to be a primary magma. So today in the tutorial that you are going to have the files ready by then, we're going to learn how to model a primary magma with different assumptions. Okay, so how let's talk again about mid-ocean ridges. We start with a peridotite. It melts. It's gonna left behind a residue, and it's gonna produce a melt. This melt is now gonna be the crust. The crust here is gonna be the melt, and then the residue is gonna be the lithospheric mantle that forms as melting as we go away from the melting regime here. One thing that is really interesting too is that melting is really efficient drying the mantle. So if there was a little bit of water in that peridotite, any tiny bit of water that was there, all that goes with the liquid. And that's why the lithosphere is rigid. The lithosphere is rigid because it lacks water. And it lacks water because it basically is the residue of partial melting. Okay, let's do a demo. Let's see if we can pull this. I was having some issues here. But I think we're going to be very successful. All right, let me see. All right, so this is an app that Mark Giorso developed. It's free. You can go to the App Store and download it. It's beautiful for teaching. And in the x-axis, there is pressure, if I'm correct. Yeah, and the y-axis is temperature. So it's upside down for every single diagram that I'm going to show you. But you can flip that in your mind, and you're going to... and it's going to work out. And pressure is megapascal and temperature is Celsius. Don't ask me why he selected those. But so the composition is I'm going to select a mantle peridotite, and I'm just going to let it go. So what this is showing us is basically a bunch of different phase diagrams, a different PT space here. So what we have here in red is melt. So here, everything is melt. Here, we don't have any melt. The components are green olivine. Let me see what else we have. Orthopyroxene is purple. And then we have spinel and plagioclase. And in some places, we're going to have garnet depending on pressure. So you can see no melt. Notice that melt start appearing here. So do you remember how we call that boundary between melt and no melt? That's the solidus, yes. So if we go and explore one of these things, it's going to tell us how much melt is there. So in this PT space, it says that there is 27, almost 30% liquid. And then there is going to be a residue in equilibrium there of olivine, orthopyroxene, and spinel. All right, so that's the first demo of how we melt the mantle. And this is going to be the first diagram that I'm going to show after this demo. And again, this is a free app, and basically has all the thermodynamics of melts and p-melts there, and also a really high pressure one that I never use. Okay. All right, so let's talk a little bit about partition of iron and magnesium. The FeO and MgO components, and Kanani talk about how important these are in the deep earth. These are also super important in the shallow mantle because the partition between these two elements, and I'm not talking about total iron. Please just be careful when you look at a database of melts or periodites. There's a big difference between FeO and FeO total, and that's something we're going to discuss a lot in the tutorial today. But the partition is relatively constant. You know, there is some variation between the magnesium content of the liquid and the KD, but overall, you know, it's something between 0.3 and 0.36. And the fact that this partition is so constant, it allows us to very simple add or subtract olivine to model melting processes. It also allows us to basically take temperature information from magnesium. And I'm going to get into the details of that a little bit more. Let's talk about first if we put again the iron magnesium diagram here, and all these lines are going to be the phosphorite content of olivine, basically how much magnesium and iron are in those olivine, and these are isophosphorite lines or isomagnesium number line. So the solidus will be someplace here, more or less, in this diagram. And that is the data from mid-ocean ridges. So if we plot all the data from the East Pacific Rise and the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, they plot someplace here, started at more or less phosphorite 90, and then you see this evolution in this direction. So what do you think is causing that change? You start with something that is very close to equilibrium with the mantle, and then things shoot into a completely different direction. What process happens after a melt separates from their source? Well, what happened? You melt the mantle. It's very hot. Then the melt goes away. What is going to happen to that melt? What is the first thing that will happen to that melt as it percolates through the lithosphere to the cold lithosphere and the cold crust? It cools down. Yeah. So when the melt cools down, basically it's going to start crystallizing phases. And as it crystallizes, and the first one is going to be olivine. And then we're probably going to have plagioclase and so on and so forth. And then what we have here is basically the evolution of all mid-ocean rich basalts, basically by fractional crystallization. In the same diagram, now I plot Iceland. And what you can notice here is that Iceland starts higher magnesium and higher iron. And there I'm comparing with Hawaii. Higher magnesium, higher iron is telling us something already about the temperature of formation. The hottest the mantle is, the highest the melt is going to be in what element? Magnesium. Why? Why magnesium? When we go back to the composition of a peridotite. Peridotite has a lot of magnesium. The highest the melt fraction is, the closer the melt is going to look like the source. All right, and this takes us to this concept of mantle potential temperature. A lot of the tutorial today is going to be how to calculate these mantle potential temperatures from Mayer element chemistry. But basically what we have here is two adiabats. We have a diagram of pressure and temperature. Do you remember it's the same diagram that I showed you before? Just the axes are flipped in a very different way. You need to kind of rotate this the other way around. Make sense? It's the same diagram I show you with phase plot. Partial melt here, all melt here, no melt here. So if you're writing this adiabat, at a certain point, you're going to hit the solidus. What happened in the solidus? Solidus, please, come on. Melts. So when you melt a peridotite, you need to invest heat or enthalpy on melting that peridotite. So it's almost like before you can buy a house, you need to put the down payment. So you need to pay your dues in terms of energy. So because we're investing that that energy on melting, basically the adiabat is going to be deflected. And then the eruptive temperature of a melt will never be the same temperature as the melt it was when it crossed the adiabat. Both because there's, you know, the adiabatic of welling and it's cooling acid of wells, but also there's a lot of investment here. So the mantle potential temperature is the basically the temperature if the adiabat closed the solidus, but it doesn't melt. Today we're going to calculate that because this is basically the way we can test if something was formed by a high temperature upwelling like a mantle plume, or if something was just caused by decompression of the upper mantle. All right. So this takes us back to the paper that Colleen published in Science in 2014. It's a little bit different than what I show you. What they did is they used the sodium, if I'm correct, sodium 9. Rather than 8, they move it to 9 because it's more mafic. And it's probably much better to do it that way. And there is this interesting correlation between sodium 9 being sodium, an incompatible element, and basically the VS. And Suzhou shows some of this data, but basically what it's telling us is that when you're close to places that are known to be thermal anomalies or mantle plumes, we have a higher mantle potential temperature calculated through the sodium composition, but also calculated by, I guess this is VS, if I am correct, yes, and VS. So I guess this is a really cool example of how can you integrate petrology and seismology together to try to understand a problem of the not so deep Earth. All right, so what is a MORP? A mid-ocean rich basalt is an olivine tholeite. Tholeite means that it has enrichments in iron. So when petrologists or geochemists said, oh, this is a tholeite, what it means is that fractional crystallization is enriching. And you remember the iron-magnesium diagram where it was going up? That's basically what a tholeitic fractionation is. And originally, petrologists thought that making MORP was really simple. You have the mantle decompressed, you make MORP. No big deal. But since O'Hara, 1968, actually, we know that this is really complex because there is all these processes of replenishment of magma chambers and fractional crystallization. So even MORPs that are supposed to be the most simple melts to work with are incredibly complicated. Plotting all the East-Pacific rice and mid-Atlantic rich composition, we start with basalts. And we actually have compositions that go all the way to the acidic melts. So sometimes people think that actually, most of the time, people think that you will never find a fractionated melt in a mid-ocean rich, but actually there are examples of that. And then you can see the huge diversity of compositions. Like MORP is not a single thing. MORP ranged in magnesium from like 10% to almost no magnesium. And you can calculate an average MORP composition, and then Dominique can take that average MORP composition and try to understand whole mantle circulation or recycling of ocean across. But there is also a huge diversity of MORPs. So not all MORPs are created equal. So when we are trying to understand heterogeneity in planet Earth, we need to understand that there is not a single composition for MORP. And that is again explained by the fact that these are not primary melts. These are all the basic product of fractional crystallization. And that just basically happened by having a series of phases. First olivine, then olivine plus plagioclase, olivine plus plagioclase and CPX. And then eventually we reach a point when magnetite crystallized. So this is just a photograph of a normal MORP basalt. This is actually highly crystalline. It's not a glassy MORP. But we also get things like gabbros. And imagine what will be the effect of recycling a gabbro. You can put a lot of strontium in a gabbro. You can put a lot of barium in a gabbro. You cannot put a lot of strontium here. So if a gabbro gets recycled for some billions of years, it's going to have a high strontium signature. This is just talking about like the variability of what recycling materials like this could basically bring back later when it comes into a mantle plume. Yes?
Sorry, I didn't get why would there be more structure in chemistry?
Because it has a lot of plagioclase. A lot of plagioclase. A gabbro can accumulate a lot of plagioclase.
Well, remind me, I mean, the chemistry. chemistry should be similar. Only difference is the grain size.
No, yeah. it's also you have a process of accumulation. So in the magma chamber, you can accumulate a lot of plagioclase. The liquid comes out, and it will crystallize a very little material. Actually, a mid-ocean rich basalt does not have a lot of crystals. But the gabbro stays in the lower crust.
So crystal grows.
And it grows, all this plagioclase stay in the lower crust.
Let me rephrase. Are you suggesting that between basalt and gabbro, the phase proportions of plagioclase and diopside will change?
It not only will change, it will be completely different because the magma chamber will have all these processes of replenishment and accumulation, and then you're going to get basalts that they're not going to have the chance to crystallize out those phases. So it's more complex than that. So if you recycle lower crust from an oceanic material, it's going to be very different than if we recycle a normal morph. What I'm trying to say here is that this recycling needs to, when we do or try to do assessment of recycling, we need to understand that there is a great deal of heterogeneity of materials going into the deep earth. And we cannot just take an average morph composition and use it as the only recycling material. And also there are some other types. You know, there's normal morph is depleted in rare earth elements here because the upper mantle is depleted, but there's something called enriched morph that probably has to do with either recycled heterogeneities or the proximity of being close to a mantle plume. All right, the only thing that I want to talk about how you make up the heterogeneity is the fact that as soon as this lavas erupted in the surface, as soon as the magma chambers cool down and they move a little bit away by spreading, there is going to be also this hydrothermal circulation happen everywhere. This is a hydrothermal system, basically a cartoon of a hydrothermal system. So basically, you're going to start injecting all this seawater into the oceanic crust. And that seawater is going to be really high in certain elements. And that seawater is going to basically transform the composition of that oceanic crust and produce hydrothermal phases. Those hydrothermal phases are fundamental for making subduction happen, for example. And those hydrophases are also very important in the way of recycling materials also. So the also using the composition of a average morph itself is not really going to solve the problem of understanding how heterogeneities develop. Because besides the variability in composition of morph, there is also this secondary process of alteration that is going to bring even more heterogeneity. I don't know if anybody's getting my point here, but what I'm trying to say here is that using an average composition for recycling assessment is probably not the most appropriate thing to do. It's the easiest, and I don't know how to tackle that because I really don't do it. But because I don't do it, it's really easy for me to tell people to do it. That.
If the processes are generic across mid-ocean ridges, then there would be probably a typical composition that you could use. And it's an ensemble of things that would be representative of a typical oceanic package that's going back down into the mantle, right?
I guess you can make that assumption.
So I guess the question is, to what extent is that true?
I don't think it's true. Yeah. I think it was good 20 years ago, 30 years ago to do things like that. I think we know this much better now.
Always going to be present, right?
Sure. All right, so let's go into subduction zones. So we talk about, there was another question there.
So for the water, you draw two, like, those things from seawater and then go to the mid-ocean ridge, and you give two reactions. I just wonder how water, like, overcome the density, because water is very light, and how does overcome the density and to react with those basalt and then go back. Because water, the density is around 1, right? And the rock is like 2.3.
Oh, it's because it's all fracture. This is a completely fractured hydrothermal system. So there is circulation here because there is heat.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all completely fractured. If you go to an ophiolite, for example, and you see a structure of the ocean crust, it's just completely full of fractures. So basically, this is a whole highly porous media. So that's how the water can circulate.
I'm asking because in your cartoon is.
This is not my cartoon, by the way.
Okay.
I of course don't have. It's the one that I don't have a citation that I was crazy trying to find. But it's not my cartoon. Yeah.
This cartoon suggests that the water in the mid ocean regions come from the seawater, but could it be possible that water in the mid ocean regions comes from the magma beneath it?
Very little. More mantle is very dry. And the signature, oxygen isotope signatures, all the signatures of these minerals show that this is basically ocean water.
But you should.
We can talk more about that later.
Okay.
Especially because, again, this is not what I do, but like we can talk. I can actually give you some papers of people that model this process, and they do much better than I will ever do on this. Okay, subduction zones. Man, I just need a little bit more. Okay, this is the next part. All right, subduction zone is where an oceanic crust goes below either oceanic crust or continental crust. All right, so we have two types of subduction systems. We have oceanic arcs and we have continental arcs. I particularly like the oceanic arcs because I feel those are the ones that tells you the early history of how continental crust formed. If you go to continental arcs, the continents are already there and it's a little bit difficult to understand. So how melts happen here? We come back to peridotites again. The mantle which probably has a significant proportion of peridotite. But we're putting down sediments now. So we have peridotite, we have sediments, and at the same time, we also have a subducting slab that is probably in an eclogenic composition. So we either squeeze fluids from here or melts happen here that will metasomatize the mantle, produce some kind of like second stage metasomatized peridotite with like peroxenite and whatever stuff you want to imagine. The beautiful thing about arcs is that you can put as much things as you want once you know the different components, and that will melt and produce an arc magma. So I am going to show another phase plot demo here. And the last time kind of worked, so let's hope this works. So it's the same phase plot. Again, we have the line here where all melts happen. And I'm going to take the same composition. We have a peridotite. And I'm going to add just 1% water. That's it, 1% water. And look at this. Now almost everything melt. So that is the effect of water on, just one second. That is the effect that water will do on the same mantle peridotite that we melted before, just by temperature and pressure, just by decompression. Now we are adding water to the system and everything melted. And there is probably a very tricky question coming from that side of the.
No, my question is really simple. there are little green dots to each assigned to the pie chart.
Oh, that means
chart?
That the model didn't fail.
Okay, so nothing failed in this diagram, but the previous diagram, there were a couple of red dots.
Some fail. That means that there was not, it didn't reach the minimal free gift-free energy conditions for Mark Giorza to approve the model to happen.
Okay, got it.
Yep, thank you. Nothing fell here. So if things fail, add water, and then they will work. All right, let's go back to the presentation. I don't really know how much time I have, but we're going to keep going with this. All right, 4 minutes. So,
40.
Oh, 40 minutes. So, look. just let me finish the thought and then I go with you. And so basically, this is what happened. This is the same diagram I showed you before. That is the effect of adding 1,000 ppm of water into the solidus. So you're moving the solidus in this direction. So what is going to happen now? Let's imagine we're in a very simple 1,300 degree adiabat. Now you're not melting the mantle here. The mantle starts melting way earlier. And that's how you make something like a bunny night. You guys heard what a bunny night before? Nobody heard what a bunny night is? Boninites are these rocks from the Bonin Islands and Japan and whatever, and they're super high in magnesium. And why they're super high in magnesium is not because they melted at really high temperatures. It's because the mantle melted a lot because it had water. So when you have a high degree of partial melt, you need to ask yourself, or a high magnesium rock, you ask yourself, is this a high magnesium rock because the temperature was hot, or this is a high magnesium rock because there was a lot of water hanging there? This is a really, really fundamental and important question. And there was another question in the back.
The water you mentioned, the 1 weight percent or 1,000 ppm, is that free water or water as a like component of those minerals?
Okay, so 1,000 ppm is the maximum water normally anhydrous minerals can hold in the mantle. Theoretically, that's the maximum water you can put there. If you add more water to that, then you probably start making phases like amphiboles or micas or things that are actually going to hold water in the structure. So what I was trying to simulate here is if you can add basically the maximum water you can hold in the mantle without having those hydrous phases.
Well, the maximum water depends on pressure and temperature conditions. So there will be many other minerals nominally anhydrous which can have
Sure, but this is I'm talking about the uppermost mantle here.
Yes, sure.
Yeah.
I understand.
Just hang with me in the upper mantle. I know you guys are all excited to talk about like the core mantle, but and I'm getting there. I'm getting there, but I'm in a subduction zone, and this is it. So, where's this water coming from? Remember, the oceanic crust is getting altered. You're making all these faces. It's not that we're squeezing water because it's not porous water. Porous water will never go here. But it's basically the breakdown of all these different secondary metamorphic phases. And you know, some people suggest that they happen in different progress of, you know, you start breaking amphiboles at a certain point, you break chloride at a certain point, eventually lawsonite and fengite. And these will always change depending on the PT conditions of the subducting slab. Okay, this is just a cartoon to tell you things break as the subducting slab goes down. Now, there's a chance that some things will not break, and you can take it all the way to the core mantle boundary. All right, so what is the element behavior in a subduction zone? So let's start making ratios, because that's, I think, the best thing to do with subduction zones is to look at things in terms of ratios. So certain elements are going to be mobilized by fluids. They like to, they basically are very happy going in a supercritical fluid. Some elements like potassium, cesium, barium, strontium, lead, those are the elements that they were called also volatile when we were talking about formation of planets. And they basically like to mobilize with fluids. So when water comes out from the subduction zone as these minerals break down, they will also carry certain elements that mobilize with fluids. And at a certain point, we can also melt the subducting slab. It all will depend on the thermal conditions of that subduction zone. And if we melt the subducting slab, we can mobilize high field strength elements. These are elements like niobium, tantalum, titanium. And these are elements that mobilize basically, like they will not go with fluid, but they would rather go with the melt. And I have two elements here that are kind of highlighted. It's boron and beryllium. The reason why we, if we work in subduction zones, we care a lot about boron and beryllium is because boron and beryllium are very similar elements. But one is mobilized by fluids, one is mobilized by melt. So we can use elements that are very similar, but basically inspect their behavior once we make this analysis. And if we make some ratios of melt mobile divided by other melt mobile element and fluid mobile divided by melt mobile, we'll have a trend like that. Arcs that are dominated by melts will plot in some direction like this. Imagine if there is only melt, the whole slab melts, we will have like just things shooting into this direction. If we only have fluids, 100% fluid, not a single melt, the line will go in this direction. But if we have some mix between both, then they will radiate in that diagram.
Okay, so, just a quick dumb question. You just showed us that as soon as we add water, the rock will melt. So
yes.
I don't understand how you can have fluid without melting in a subduction zone.
I'm showing a diagram a little bit later, and it has to do with the PT conditions. You may not be able to basically cross the solid as of certain things depending on the temperature and pressure conditions. Okay?
Can I just add, Yvette, I think that was about mantle melting and this is about the slab melting.
Thank you.
No, but it's also a matter of what is the PT conditions of the system. You can melt anything, it's just how hot you can get it, you know, or what is the right pressure. And some slabs may just not really go through that. There is a couple of questions there.
What do you mean when you say fluid mobile elements?
These are elements that mobilize with fluids.
What do you mean?
Fluid is not melt in my world.
But what exactly?
Super critical fluids.
Yeah, and what exactly mobile mean?
Like, mobile means that they like to ride the fluid train. They will go together with the fluid. So.
Oh, partition.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay.
So, just to clarify that, I mean, I guess initially there would be fluid coming out. Wonderful. Sorry. So I think initially the fluids will come out of the dehydration products of hydrous phases, and then eventually this fluid will interact with melt in a PT space that can, I can easily draw that and show you, and then eventually there will be miscibility at higher pressures. That will become the supercritical fluid that you're talking about. But eventually there will be fluid, so there's no problem of having fluid coming out of the subducting slab.
All right, let's to get a little bit more information about like some global systematics of ARCs, please, you can see the Planck and Lamure paper from 93. There is a more recent kind of synthesis paper by Ryan Achevel, and very recently also there is another global ARC systematic papers by Turner and Lamure. Those are kind of three papers to start looking at global systematic of ARCs. And basically what I'm doing right now is basing our recent work on some of their basically work that championed this in the past. All right, so I couldn't, you know, not give this talk with putting one spider diagram. And what is interesting about subduction zones is the subduction zones, what I have actually here is that this is the composition of the total continental crust and also Archean TTGs. And basically, our magmas will reproduce these signatures. Oh, sorry. This is a morph. This is an upper morph. A morph male will have this very depleted composition. These elements are called incompatible elements. That means that they don't like to be in the mantle. Once we have melt, they're just going to go up. But then you have all these wiggles going up and down in arcs. And you got the same wiggles in continental crust. So to me, this is one of the strongest evidence from a geochemical perspective that to make continental crust, you need to have some kind of subduction going on. That is completely my biased position on this. So I'm just getting it out. And these elements are, the ones that are going down are probably sequestered in the subducting slab. The ones that go up are the ones that come in fluids, like lead, for example. Lead likes to go in a fluid, so it will go up. These elements stay in the subducting slab. So unless you melt the slab, these guys are going to go back. And you know where they come back? They come back later in Hawaii. All right, let's go to the arcs again. So if we look at all these trends from global arcs, we have some arcs that indeed trend in the direction of dominated by a melt component like Sonda, or the Aeolian Islands here. And there are some other arcs, like Tonga or Isu Bonin, that goes in a direction more dominated by a fluid. And then we have stuff in between. You know, we have some things in between. If we use the same diagram, kind of almost the same that we did before, but I'm basically putting boron here. These are mostly fluid mobile elements. We looked at they go into different trends. So some are really high in barium, and that can be explained because these subduction zones have carbonate subduction. baryon is an element that is going to be really high when you have carbonates. Actually, if you go and make an analysis of a carbonate, where's the closest limestone here? Are there limestones around here? Yeah, well, you travel somewhere, get a limestone, you analyze it. There's a lot of baryon, there's a lot of strontium in a limestone. So molar are actually, you know, they go in a component that have very low baryon because there is no carbonate input in those subduction zones. So this goes back to Thet's question. How we melt the subducting slab, or how we melt the sediment in a subducting slab. These are PT path of subduction zones. This is a hot subduction zone like in Mexico. This is a cold subduction zone like Tonga. Temperature versus pressure, and this is basically tracking the path of a subducting slab. These are coming from Syracuse et al. 2010. If you guys want to learn more about this, this is a great paper that shows basically different PT paths. Now, this is a simple PT path. It's a 2D PT path and doesn't include things like, you know, convection by, what is this? A slab of things like that. But overall, it gives you a good idea.
So it's at the top of the slab, or?
This one is at the top of the slab. They did it at different levels, at the top, middle, lower. This one is the top of the slab because I was interested in melting sediments or trying to see if you can melt sediments. So the red line is the PT path of Mexico, and the green line is the solidus of melting sediment. So what happened is that in a place like a hot subducting slab, like this one in Mexico, you will easily cross that solidus at conditions where the sediment is going to melt. Well, in other places, in Tonga, you lose it. You will never, ever cross the solidus. At least with these PT conditions, you know. There may be some other things that could happen. I remember the words of Peter Kellerman here. You don't need to hold yourself a slave to the PT path of the subducting slab because you can also separate a diapir. If you separate a diapir of sediment from here, it will also cross the solidus at a certain point. So if you have a more dynamic idea of how a subduction zone works with these diapirs going everywhere, maybe there's sediment melting everywhere. And actually, that's what that diagram is showing. By combining these two elements, this is a fluid model, and this is a two-mel model elements, you can see that there is a global trend that suggests that there may be some melt of sediments everywhere. So maybe this idea of diapir separating from the subducting slab also work in places where the slab is cold.
I have a question. So is there estimation how much of a sediment can survive? Survive means going into the deep mantle for us.
You can actually use intraplane magmas to do that. And there's very, very, very almost nothing.
Okay.
There's this places, Samoa, you can see it in Samoa.
So 99% goes back to the surface?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. I think Brack Hacker is correct with that. Like, very, very little sediment goes down. If not, every single oceanic island of planet Earth should have a subduction, a sediment signature. Again, this is my interpretation and my bias here, please. Dominique.
Just wondering, where did you make this compilation, or where is it coming from?
This is you of course didn't put a reference. No, it's a paper I published 2 years ago. I can send it to you.
Yeah, I'm sure I have it. I'll go back to look at it, though.
It's actually, this paper is Samboni et al. 2016. It's a GQ paper, maybe? another global compilation done by Sarah Pennington-Dorland showed that if you go to ultra-high pressure complexes, like basically the rocks that visit the mantle and came back, like the Catalina Island, very close, we're so close to Catalina Island. If you look at that, that agrees also with my idea that I showed before, that probably there's slab melts everywhere, or because if you look at data coming from those materials that visited the mantle, in these ultra-high pressure complexes, they trend towards the hot subduction regime. Now, why they go in that direction? Not necessarily because they went in a hot subducting slab. It's because these things probably detach from the subducting slab, visited the subducting the mantle a little bit, and then somehow came back in a subducting channel in probably the most complicated process in planet Earth that I don't understand. All right.
I just wanted to point out that what we're looking at here is more or less today, and that if we think back in time, which is relevant for perhaps the deep Earth, that the conditions may have changed.
It was way hotter in the past. And that's like, if I can ever go to that final part of my talk, that's where things become hot, interesting, and deep. All right, so why we care about like a slab melts? And we should care about the slab melts because arcs that are dominated by the slab melts produce continental crust. I'm being a little bit biased to my work here again, but I think there's a story there, and I'm going to show you a little bit of this really fast so we can go to the deep Earth. So I'm going to talk really fast about the formation of the land bridge between North and South America, and this evolved really fast in the last 12 million years. I'm also super biased because I was born in Costa Rica. So not everybody is so lucky to get a geology degree in a place that is so diverse in terms of geology. So what we did here is that we actually found a geochemical evolution in the arc that started with these are lead isotopes versus age. Lead isotopes are heavy isotopes that do not fractionate by magmatic processes or melting, that basically trace in the source. So it's like if you're basically examining the composition of the source through melts in the surface. So the compositions are relatively depleted, and then as soon as the arc starts interacting with subducting Galapagos tracts, the Cocos Ridge or the Coiba Ridge, there are these guys here, as soon as we start having interaction, then this completely changed and turn the arc into a more radiogenic composition. So what we should care, there is like a trend there, so what? What matters is that we can actually trace that composition back to the subducting seamounts here. And this is just a cartoon showing that the composition of the volcanoes here mimic the composition of the subducting material here. So we're actually tracing back the composition of the output by examining also the input in the arc. And this input is really interesting because it's really enriched. This is another ratio diagram, but this is used to study old rocks. And the reason why people use that to study old rocks is because these elements are not altered by, or not significantly affected by alteration. And we use the same diagram just to show that Archean oceanic crust has very similar composition to what is subducting offshore. Basically, the Archean oceanic crust were relatively enriched in trace elements compared to today's oceanic crust, and that has to do with the fact that the mantle has been more and more depleted with time. Another thing that is interesting is that the subducting material is really young. It's like less than 12 million years, so we're subducting something really young, really hot, is enriched, probably melts. And what happened is this. More spider diagrams. So this just helped me with some wiggle matching. The wiggles do not really match, but now they kind of match. So even if you're not a geochemist, I think there's a little convincing evidence here. And what matters at the end is that the arc evolved from a mafic arc to an arc that now it has the same silica and sodium range of continental crust. So there is a trace element, isotopes, and major element change that happened when these materials start melting in the subducting slab. So what we should care? What we should care about how the continental crust is made. And what we should care is because the production of continental crust basically shift all the geochemical cycles of planet Earth. Before the continents were formed, probably the most dominant process in the planet was serpentinization. The atmosphere was very different than the atmosphere we have today. And it's after the production of continents that things like oxygen can potentially survive. So we won't be here, the planet won't be the planet that is today, we didn't have continents. The other thing that is super important is that a nutrient like phosphorus is highly concentrated in the continental crust. There's almost no phosphorus in the ocean in the ocean crust. And without phosphorus, you cannot have life because it's another nutrient that is fundamental to the production of life on Earth. So the explosion of life and the formation of life, as we know, depending on the formation of continental crust on the planet. All right. And then this diagram shows that as the crustal mass decreases in magnesium, as the crustal mass grows, they also decrease in magnesium. So that's what I'm saying, that probably the process that dominated was serpentinization. Another thing that is important is that continental crust is unique to planet Earth. If we want to understand the evolution of our planet, we also need to understand the shallowmost part of the planet. Sujoy said the other day, well, the continental crust is only 2% of the planet or less. But I think it's the one that basically brings a lot of secrets of how the planet actually formed. And most of the formation, or the peak of continental crust formation, happened between 2.5 and 3.5 billion years ago. That is also the same record that you can get from the formation of the lithosphere. And this correlates with, this is kind of not working. It correlates also with the time in planet Earth that temperatures were hotter. So this goes back to what Roberta said before. The conditions we have today were not the conditions we have in the Archeans in terms that the mantle was really hot. So imagine putting a subducting slab in a super hot mantle. It's going to melt everywhere. So my interpretation of how continents form, if we use a uniformitarianism perspective here, is that they form basically by melting subducting slabs in the Archean. And there is an example here from the Abitibi granite greenstone belt. Basically, you have both things, these things called TTGs that are the roots of the continents. So you have continental crust together with really hot, hotly produced basalt, suggesting that there was kind of this interaction between really hot mantle and probably a subducting slab. That's my interpretation again. All right. So there are two competing models to make continental crust, but basically the general recipe is that we start with an ecogite, we add water and heat, and we make continental crust. If it was this easier, then we will solve the problem, but we know the ingredients, but we don't know the recipe. Today there are two main models that compete. The subduction model is the one that I focus today. There's also this other one called the stagnalite that basically suggests that we have this stagnalite that grew so much that it delaminated. And when it delaminates, it melts and produces continental crust. The problem with that model is that Mars and Venus, in kind of a stagnalite regime, never successfully produce continental crust. Only Earth. So that's a little bit of a problem with the stagnalite model, in my opinion. So just to finish this, I think I have 15 minutes to go to the mantle plume. It looks that about 2.7 billion years ago is where the continental masses became stable. And according to the new data that I show you, melting of enriched subducting slab is probably key to produce continents as they were recorded in the early Earth. And it's all about slab melts, I think. All right, let's go to mantle plumes. I don't know if I'm going to be able to pull this out, but let's try. All right, so why we care about mantle plumes or intraplate volcanoes is because that's the place we can sample the deep Earth. We're moving from very shallow to deep now. And mantle plumes are not only unique to Earth. That's the way volcanoes in Mars are explained. That's the only way you can explain these gigantic volcanoes there in Mars is by having some kind of thermal anomaly for a really long time. And actually, there are numerical models that simulate that mantle plumes basically can explain volcanism in Mars. All right, so how we study mantle plumes, so what is the structure of a mantle plume? It starts generally, or the idea is that it starts with this big upwelling coming from the deep Earth, and that's what is called the plume head. When it melts, it produces float basalt. And after that happening, we get the tail that is going to be the conduit of the communication, this communication between the deep earth here, where there's some recycling and heterogeneities. And then, you know, we have the continued material ascending. Leaves are large igneous provinces are really important structures. These are planetary wide structures. If I put the Ontonjawa Manihiki Hikurangi plateau that happened about 120 million years ago, it fits in the about 60-70% of the continental United States. So when I start this talk, I said mid-ocean ridges make the most magma today, but they do not compare with a large igneous. Just the Ontonjawa plateau, it almost doubles the production of what a mid-ocean ridge will do in a year. What they're also important because they correlate really well with mass extinctions. So, you know, I don't know you guys, but I don't want to be here when one of these come to the surface. And there is enough evidence that suggests that both hotspots and large igneous provinces, they're probably sampling the LLSPPs. A recent global tomography showed that some of our favorite hotspots are actually connected to the deep earth, to these structures that people like to call mantle plumes. And it's also possible that the large igneous provinces were also related with this LLSBPs at the core mantle boundary. So we did this study here that basically we made a global survey of different oceanic lips, and this is all focused on the Pacific. And our idea was to test the hypothesis if they are related, if the LLSBPs were related with the formation of large igneous provinces. And what we found is that besides the fact that there are some pulses, not cyclicity, but pulses of production of large igneous provinces, the majority of these large igneous provinces correlate with what is called the normal Cretaceous supercron. This is, I think it's 40 million years that the core did not flip polarity. So this is evidence, in my opinion, of a direct connection between the deep earth and large igneous provinces. The flux of material was probably so big that influenced the dynamo. In this study, we showed that basically what happened is that when they reached the surface, they triggered new rifting and produced a lot of magmas. And basically, whenever these mid-ocean ridges intersected the edges of the LLSBP is when a large igneous province formed. And we found also some interesting correlations. We have a good correlation between sodium and melt fraction. And we're going to learn a little bit more how to calculate melt fraction in the tutorial today. But you can see some differences between, in red we have large igneous provinces with higher melt fraction and also lower sodium. And higher sodium in the modern oceanic islands and lower melt fraction. And there is a good correlation with silica too. The higher the silica, that means that it melted more shallow. And the way that we explain this is that mid-ocean ridges are produced by this simple decompression we discussed before, making a very limited melt column. In a modern ocean island basalt setting, we have it start melting deep because it crossed the solid as deeper, but then we have oceanic lithosphere that stopped melting, while in a large igneous province, basically, we have this huge upwelling that trigger rifting. So we have almost like a combination between a really gigantic mid-ocean ridge and a mantle plume, a big mantle plume. All right, so the lips probably came from the edges of the LLSVP too. And today we're going to learn how to calculate this. I probably have like 5 minutes, maybe, Is that good, 5 minutes? 10 minutes. All right, I have 10 minutes. 5 minutes. whatever, deal. So how we calculate the temperatures of melts? Basically, the magnesium content of the melt is our thermometer. So mid-ocean-rich primary magma will sit here. They form something like 350 degrees. As we go in this direction, we have higher magnesium. That means that they're recording higher temperatures. So we can take the mirror element chemistry of large igneous provinces and compare it to oceanic islands. And that's the results we have here. We have basically large igneous provinces that melted at hotter temperatures than all oceanic islands today. But everybody, overall, large igneous province and also ocean island basalts, they're all hotter than more. So this is temperature evidence that mantle plumes do exist, and they come from a very hot, deep place. We can do a little bit more detail examining of the Galapagos plume and the large igneous province related with the modern hotspot today. And these are some examples of the places we sample. And what is really cool is that they are really primitive. They have beautiful olivine. And we included data from a bunch of different terrains all over the Caribbean. And I guess, let me see, I'm going to move this fast because that doesn't matter too much. I'm going to move to the end really fast. Let me see where we are. I had a lot of more things here to share with you. But I think we spent a lot of time in the phase diagram. Okay, so let me finish. Okay, I'm gonna be more efficient because we don't have a lot of time, and I'm just gonna skip this. No, that's not what it is. Here. Well, I thought it was going to be a very smooth presentation. So what we found on the Galapagos is that when we move from the plume head stage, we get indications from the olivine chemistry that allow us to have recycled components in their source. I'm going to get a little bit more into the details of that in the tutorial of how nickel is a good indicator of recycled components. But basically what happened is that we have this secular cooling in the plume, really hot in the early stage of the plume, and then it decreases with time. So there is a nice cooling of the plume here, and that correlates really well with the appearance of new recycled components. So my interpretation is that when the plume was basically coming to the surface, it was so hot that it diluted the heterogeneities. And then as it cools down, then now we preferentially melt heterogeneities that are more fertile. So I'm going to finish with another phase plot, the final phase plot demo here. And what I'm going to do is, we're going to change the composition from a peridotite. Okay, let's do a peridotite again, just to remind you of a peridotite without water. So that's a peridotite with no water. We have the solidus there. Now let's move and let's melt a peroxenite. This is theoretically a recycled component. So we're going to change to a peroxenite. And look at that. You don't need a lot of temperature to melt the peroxenite. It's more fertile. We can get into the phase diagram of how that works too and have a lot of fun with that. But basically, the fact that it's so fertile, where is the solidus here? You know, it's maybe here. So you can have a recycled component that you don't need a lot of high temperature to melt it. And I guess I want to finish my talk with that, basically, and by saying that there is a lot of complexity in the deep earth. And not everything is a peridotite. And if we have, you know, a lot of eons of subduction, or putting subducting slab in the deep earth, that means that we need to be more concerned about trying to understand what is the role of these heterogeneities too. All right, thank you. Yes?
Sorry. I can't help but noticing that when you talk about Hawaii, you talk about Mauna Kea.
Yes.
Have you done the calculation with an average Mauna Loa?
You can't, because Mauna Loa is mostly a peroxenite, I think. So all this, what if you come to the demo, I thought you may be able to come later. We're going to talk about that, like all the experimental petrology to calculate mantle temperatures and all that stuff needs to be a prototype source. And I think a lot of the Mauna Loa samples plot below the calcium discrimination for a peroxenite. So it's still going to be hot, but it's a little bit difficult to figure out what temperature is.
Well, it's clearly a different source, but it would be interesting to see where we can go with that.
I think we should do it with another thing, like maybe olivine spinel temperatures or something like that, and then project it to the source.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Bruce.
So when you were talking about mid-ocean ridges and getting temperatures, you reminded us to be concerned about the fact that water can shift and change the temperatures. And you didn't give us that caution when you talked about the lips and the plumes and things like that. Do those arguments also apply?
So one of the things that I'm working right now is to actually get in the water contents of large igneous provinces and intraplate magmas. And it's never as high. They do have water, but it's never as high as the water that you will get in an arc.
So your expectation is it's smaller?
Yeah, but we need to quantify that. So we're working on that. That's one of the big questions. Remember, like Sue Joy talked about some of the 10 big questions that we need to work on. That's one of those. So we're working really hard on that, and hopefully in a few years, I will be able to do a better assessment of what is the effect of water on melting in a plume or in a large igneous province. So far, what we know is that it's not a lot of water.
Let's go have lunch.